Thank you for joining us tonight. This is James Dossie with Vigilance Press, and you are listening to the Vigilance Press podcast. Tonight, my special guest is Jack Norris, Green Ronin superstar writer, and and he's also been contributing some really cool stuff for us here at Vigilance Press lately. Hey, Jack, how you doing?
I'm doing okay, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. It's always nice when you see good reviews on your stuff just before going into
a podcast. It is.
But you actually have a bunch of stuff that's about to come out in kind of short succession to each other. And so I figure we'd bring you on the show and talk to you about some projects you have coming up. Now, one of the things that's coming up for you in October is the threat reports, right?
Yes, at least one of the reports. I've got two that are definitely coming out. There should be two more that hopefully will be coming out, but there's one that's coming out in October, and then there's more down the line, hopefully.
Oh, okay. What's the one coming out in October?
So let me give you the elevator pitch for this, which is because it's what they liked when I gave it to them. I was noting that one of the things we were looking at with threat reports is kind of adding things that aren't in the Freedom City universe already. And I had noticed, rightly or wrongly, and it turned out I was right, that there didn't seem to be sort of the relatively specialized but fun villain version of like classic monster plus like space cosmic monster to make a new villain. For example, in Marvel and DC Comics, folks like Starbreaker in DC, the cosmic vampire, Man-Wolf in Marvel, the sort of the space werewolf. Those characters aren't very common, but they are a thing that pops up. And so I was thinking, I can't think of a space mummy. I can think of some characters that are Egyptian themed and cosmic, like the Sphinx and Immortus, depending on how he's feeling that day and what he pulls out of his wardrobe. And of course, Kang's used like Egyptian soldiers, like he's used soldiers from every single time period. And of course, all those guys are also technically Kang anyway. But comics, everybody, gotta love them. But I never really had a mummy that I was aware of. There wasn't really a space mummy character in the Freedom City, and it wasn't a super common thing in Marvel or DC. So I said, hey, let's do a space mummy. And then I decided that, I looked around. But one thing I did look at Freedom City is there's a lot of Egyptian stuff. Maybe not a lot, but more than I thought.
Well, there's a legacy hero that they kept offering to the for the players to use, the Red Scarab, right?
Well, I think it was just Scarab. Scarab. You had the Scarab. You had Horus the Avenger was sort of their version of Thor, which there was some Egyptian connections to, I think it was Egyptian mysticism with some of the stuff that Shadow was involved with, maybe. I might be misremembering that, but there was definitely a chunk of Egyptian stuff out there already. And so I'm like, well, let's do a mummy from a different, like, model after a mummy of a different culture. So I came up with, and I did some research, I looked at some, I did some stuff, and I was already leaning towards Mesoamerican anyway, but I found some, I was looking at the Olmecs, and the Olmecs are a Mesoamerican culture we don't know a lot about, which actually turned out to be fantastic for what I wanted to do. They're known primarily for their jade masks and their big giant stone heads that they carved, and they're sort of like pre-Aztec, pre-Toltec civilization. They were one of the first real builders and such in that region. And I was, of course, I did the thing of saying, well, let's go a little Kirby and let's go a little ancient astronaut, and let's say that, one of the reasons they did this was some alien came down and helped them, pushed them along. And then let's say at some point he went crazy and decided he wanted to, like, rule. And then let's say at some point he got mummified and imbued with cosmic power, and now he's out. And so that's basically
not the world's most simple origin story, but it's comics.
No, it's really not. I mean, the character has a decent chunk of ink devoted to its origin. It was very much a sort of a Jack Kirby, sort of like, John Byrne Fantastic Four era sort of bad guy. Take something from an ancient, take something a little bit of alien, a little bit of history, a little bit of cosmic, throw it all together and get your bad guy, which is Keith's coming up. I'm guessing I can say the name of it. If not, I guess John will just make us bleep it out.
I'll bleep it out.
Yeah, it's Kutu the Eternal, because I wanted to go for a very Kirby-esque name, which was usually something, you know, the name then the something, like Ronan the Accuser or something.
Right.
And Kutu is actually the old Olmec title for that they gave their sort of King of Kings. There, it's a combination of their sort of high priest and their sort of head governor character. So when I read that, I was like, that's the guy's name. That was like, that's it. That's him. That is clearly him. And then of course, because he's a Mesoamerican alien and I'm a big comics nerd, he had to have things like Jaguar Man and some other minions. I'm actually not going to describe the other minion because I just want people to be surprised.
Oh, wow. So he's not simply a loner character. He's one of these that comes packing some additional support.
He's designed to be a big, scary cosmic mastermind.
Awesome.
I know some folks were asking about, some folks online and on the Atomic Think Tank and other where we're saying they wanted some more threat reports to really challenge the higher level stuff. And
so what power level is he?
I'm trying to remember. I believe I want to say he was 14. Okay. And he might have been 13. I'm pretty sure it was 14. I know there was a version of him that was 13, but I think I amped him up a little bit.
Okay.
He's got his minions also are fairly powerful. I mean, I think they're power level 8-9 minions. I mean, they're definitely designed. I mean, they're minions still, so one hit will take them down. But it's designed to be. I mean, this is a guy who attacks a city and takes it over. You know, or he takes over a small country. You know, and the heroes have to team up to stop him. And that's cool. If he works with other villains, you know, it's probably going to be pretty rare. But, you know, he might sort of promise other villains power and such, and so you might have some lackeys. But he is definitely designed to be sort of a, you know, he comes in, he makes grandiose speeches and, you know, talks about how he's going, you know, the humans will bow before the superior being that he is, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's very much he's even got a hook in his character that's discussed, which if he completes part of his schemes, he will actually become even more powerful. And he's already got nothing he's already nothing to sneeze at. But
very cool.
So you could really, I mean, I really want to make somebody that would be a fun, wacky one-off, like, you know, you could defeat him and all the heroes are on your, you know, all the players are on your gaming table to look at it and go, we just beat up a space mummy. That's cool. alternatively, you could use this guy as a basis for an entire campaign, or you could have him as a major reoccurring villain. I mean, that's the idea would be to have a guy like that. And so that's with a little bit of goofiness, with also but kind of that fun Kirby over the top cosmic powered goofiness. Not the, you know, I didn't want a guy dressed as a giant clown or something. I just wanted somebody who was, you know, pretty scary and pretty potent. But also had that sort of follow up of being very, you know, like, you know, when you think about him, he's a megalomaniacal space mummy. So, I guess don't think too hard unless you like that sort of thing, in which case think about it a lot.
I definitely can't wait for that one.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. That's actually, I will say that this idea is one of the ones that when I occasionally tell my friends and stuff about what I'm working on, that was one of the ones that several of my gamer friends were like, that is so fantastic. We really see that in print. So,
very cool, very cool. So I guess we can't really go into too much more detail on him without.
You're gonna see him
spoiling.
Soon. So yeah, and you're gonna see him soon. I mean, I could say that he's got possibly one of my favorite. I won't say what the other one is. As awesome as Alien Jaguar Men are, he's got one of my favorite minions I've ever created or came up with for characters. And I won't go beyond. I won't say anything beyond that. It is just. They're goofy, they're awesome, and I'm really looking forward to seeing some sort of illustrated representation or something of them, because they're also both genre and historically appropriate too. So, you know, that's about all I'm going to tease about them. So
cool.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, I'm sure there's going to be somebody who's going to be upset with me, but no offense was meant. It was actually meant out of and it isn't like racist or anything. It's just, I was definitely taking sort of a cultural artifact of in a culture that wasn't mine and using it to make a big weapon, a big scary weapon thing. But it was honestly done in part because I was sitting here going, I don't remember the last time we've seen anything with the Olmecs. You know, it was actually done with the idea being, let's put something out there that wasn't being done. You know, let's without being, you know, lecturey and educatey, you know, let's maybe throw a little bit of fun in there, but a little something a little more, you know. And again, know, all sorts of stuff about Egypt and ancient Greece and stuff has been thrown out in comics over the years. And Freedom City, especially, has got plenty of fantastic stuff that's full of that. And so I was thinking, well, let's do something Mesoamerican. And I, you know, the Aztecs and other things didn't quite work for the time period I was looking at. And the Olmecs were perfect. So
perfect.
That worked out pretty cool. So, yeah. So look for, people like it. Should be coming soon. I don't know exactly when, but I think, you know, next few weeks, I think. So.
Okay. And I was talking to John Lighthouser just last week, and he mentioned that the only thing holding up your next project was actually him. I don't know if you've listened to that podcast yet, but
I hadn't got a chance to yet, but that's good.
Yeah,
to know,
your next publication or the next thing being published for you through Green Ronin is the fourth chapter of the Hero's Journey adventure series. Now, according to John, he needs to get a couple of maps drawn up, and yeah, I think that's the only thing left. So it sounds like he's already got all the art and the layout done. So it's just a matter of getting these two maps done.
We've edited it out. We've done the whole thing. John was gracious enough, actually, you know, for us, he's technically holding it up, but John was gracious enough to handle the maps. He asked me if I had some ideas on how to do it. And I, you know, basically was real honest and, you know, again, you heard it here first, kids. I was like, yeah, you don't want me to draw up a map. my scanner wasn't working. I just moved, which made it more problematic. You may not mind me drawing up a map if you give me like graph paper and stick it in front of me. But having the temporary inability to do that, you really don't want me to like try to use any sort of computer program to make a map. It is either going to result in a lot of cursing or you're going to look at that. Is this some sort of like, did Jackson Pollock just design this? Yeah.
That's
what
that's the corner of Jackson and Pollock.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that was sort of, you know, I he said, you know, we need maps. And I was like, oh, really? I wish you told me that before. So I could have been working on them like a while ago and maybe borrowed the skills of someone I know who has more skill at doing that. I'm doing the fourth chapter of the Hero's Journey, the Big Emerald City Silverstorm story arc, which is in my installment. The heroes are a little more established now. They're sort of, you know, they've saved the day a few times, and they're brought in to help with Redshift Industries, which is one of the big scientific places, sort of a Star Labs version in Emerald City. They're brought in to stop a villain attack, and it's a whole new villain team that's available. So there's some twists and reasons why, you know, they may or may not stay together after this adventure is up. But all the individual characters will probably be sticking around the Freedom City, Emerald City universe somewhere, including a couple characters I really, really liked. I mean, I liked all of them. There's a couple actually were a lot of fun to make and a lot of fun to design. They also have an interesting hook in that, you know, they're all intentionally a little Iron Age-y without being like crazy Iron Age-y. I wanted to sort of make a team that was a little seemed like something you might have found in the 90s, which is funny because I'm not actually a big Iron Age comic fan, particularly that sort of. I mean, I like the early Iron Age, but I'm not a big fan of the later stuff. But I just got struck with the idea of, you know, it was sort of the middle-ish end of this arc. And so I was thinking maybe have Iron Age characters in the middle of that just seemed weirdly thematically appropriate when sort of the tone shifted. I also like the idea that, you know, you're beating up on them, so, you know, that as heroes. So, you know, I didn't mind making guys who are Iron Age-y who are getting beat up on too much. They're going to be that, and then they're going to be a big brawl towards the end of the adventure. It's actually the whole fourth chapter is basically one big rolling brawl, which sounds probably not all that interesting story wise, but the rolling brawl happens, and throughout that, the big mystery of the whole arc will be revealed. It's a series of fights, some investigating on what the heck is going on in the middle, and by the end of the last fight, when the heroes get to it, they're going to have, you know, a lot of the pieces are going to be in place, and pretty much all the players will be on the board at that point. And, you know, that at that point, you know, then as I understand, Chapter 5 and Chapter 6 are really going to lead into the heroes really kind of got to save everybody. You know, they've now had it been put in front of them that this is how it's going to, you know, what they're going to do. And four really leads into that. That's the big, you know, sort of super fight before that. It also introduced or expands on some new stuff, brand management, which is sort of a vaguely nefarious sort of super private military corporation, is detailed a bit in there as well. And you got
that's a great pun.
yeah, really well. That, I can't take credit for that one. That was not me. And some agents for that are going to be included to give people an idea of how they'd use that character in Freedom City games and such. Trying to think if there's anything else that's really... Oh, the other big thing is that the actual... one of the big villains for the whole arc, there's sort of two major forces in it. One of them will be statted up and included, as I understand, unless that's been moved to a different chapter. But it was created, and it's going to be sort of a new villain, a new mastermind level villain for sort of the Emerald City setting, way more tied to Emerald City than, say, a lot of the other villains that have popped up before, which were either more tied to Freedom City or the Freedom City universe as a whole. Mm-hmm. This character is very tied to Emerald City. So if you're using the Emerald City setting, it's going to be really useful in that regard. And if you're not, it's still, you know, it's still a world-class mastermind. So you're not – so you know, just because that character is tied to the local frame, I mean, it's her ambitions are worldwide.
Okay.
It's also going to be a female mastermind. So, you know, kind of not – I mean, not that there are none of them, but it's kind of fun to have an extra one of those out there too.
Cool. So very cool.
So yeah, I'm looking forward to that. It should be fun. It was a lot of fun to work on, and I'm particularly looking forward to seeing the artist renditions of some of the stuff, because obviously, you know, I don't draw the stuff myself, so it's always just, you know, I come up with the idea, I shoot a description, and you know, then I get to wait and along with everybody else to see how awesome it looks when
you just make more work for me.
Well, you know, so. which is probably a wonderful segue into of this.
Also released for you just this past weekend. Yes. Was the Octoberman, your first project for Vigilance Press.
Yeah, my first project for Vigilance Press, and quickly becoming one of my favorite projects in a while. I mean, especially like, you know, I mean, I kind of got to give, you know, a special love and shout out to, like, you know, I'm working on the Marvel RPG now. I don't know if people are aware of that, but hey, I am.
Oh, yeah.
I'm working on, you know, I worked on DC, and that's fantastic. But doing something like the Octoberman is always fun because you kind of get to come in and just do something completely from the ground up. And that was, I don't know if James wants to tell the story of how this all happened, but I think it's hysterical.
Well, it was, I don't remember if I've told this on the podcast yet or not, but my favorite thing about working with Jack is his complete unpredictability with deadlines. and I say favorite when I mean least favorite. No, I'm just kidding. I bumped into him at this year's, Gen Con, and, bumped into, we'd planned to meet, but,
right.
I basically took him aside and said, look, I wanted to, you know, start a new line of, you know, GM supplements called Do Vigilance for Vigilance Press. And I wanted to make a point of making these team-oriented collections. And so I wanted teams [S2] Right. [S1] That could easily be dropped into any game. And, you know, primarily I'm thinking of Mutants and Masterminds at the time, because I was listening and one of the things that popped up on the forums was people were asking about teams and team tactics. Yeah. and villains that came out in a team. And it made me think that one of my favorite teams from Freedom City, as odd as it sounds, is the Power Corps, who are basically one set of stats, but a bunch of different descriptions. But the utility of a mercenary team that you could just drop into any story in media res and just say, well, these guys were hired, you know, as thugs because I need another fight scene. It's just really useful as a GM. Right. And yet I wanted some more personality and some more teams like that, that were a little more mercenary, a little more motivated to appear in different stories. So I talked to you about it, and I said, you know, I also want something with a mystic angle.
Yeah.
And Jack goes, well, you know, I'll think about it. I'll see if I can come up with anything. And then the next day he dropped by my table and said, okay, I've got the team mostly written.
Yeah, that's pretty much that. And then that happened. Seriously. I sat down with, I was, my folks live in Indianapolis. And so I was staying with them that night for Gen Con, and I got home and I was, there was nothing going on. Everybody gone to bed, and I couldn't sleep. And I popped open Hero Lab, and I'm like, well, I'll try making the stats. You know, let's see if the stats aren't going to happen. You know, normally I write the characters first. I had a couple ideas, but I said I'll work on the stats and see if I can make them work the way I want to make them work. And I'd kind of thrown out a couple really, really, really loose ideas to James. I was like, oh, you know, we're doing mystical guys, maybe like a floating skull with magical powers. And then James suggested, you should totally have a character named Jack, because that'll be funny. And we don't have one of those in, like, the stuff we've done. And I said, I could do, you know, I was thinking about, like, the Legend of Springhill Jack, which is an actual Victorian sort of folklore tale. And
he's sort of like a much more dangerous version of Nessie.
yeah. And you know, or it's a much more comic book version of Jack the Ripper, depending on how you want to look
at it. Exactly, yeah.
I came up with that, and then I started thinking, and you know, I started coming up with the various characters, and it was funny because, you know, then of course it just hit from there. And I actually had lunch. I had dinner with a friend of mine. I had mentioned to him this idea, and I was saying, I got a couple ideas, but I'm not sure I can fill out the team. And he was the one who actually pointed me at Sister Sanguine, who was sort of the final piece of that puzzle to come together. He had actually suggested, you know, a vampire character, and then James was, I think, rightly said, you know, hey, let's you know, there's a lot of vampires out there. Let's do something vampiric, but not vampire. I said, okay, cool. And then he came up, he suggested, well, can we do something with the fairy or something? And I said, well, yeah, well, now that you've said that, I think I can come up with something. So,
was one of those things where the idea really just clicked, and it's like, you know, the way I play the Fae, that they, you know, at least the Unseelie Court in my games, they're a lot, they take the role that vampires usually do of the creepy things right. that hide in shadows, and so often we see the glittery, fancy ballroom gown version of the Fae right. Court. I wanted to show something a little more visceral and scary.
Yeah, it really, really didn't do that version of the Fae Court. If folks pick up the October Man and read the Rude Sister Sanguine's origin, really, really didn't do that version. I also did one thing I did with her too that I liked was I really went out of my way to make it clear that the Fae in the setting, at least default wise for the group, and obviously if people want to change this, they can change it. I have her meet the sort of Unseelie Court in South America because I like the idea that, look, you know, if they're fairy creatures and they're super powerful, they should be everywhere. And, you know, yes, the stories all tend to come from, you know, Northern Europe, England, Ireland, you know, Scotland, et cetera.
Well, one of the things I like about fairy stories is that they're actually every culture that has
exactly, and I kind of wanted
some sort of
kind of wanted to go for something that was like sort of fae-like in a in a different setting, but also tie into the whole thing. But no, so you know, I came up with these characters, and we put them together, and they clicked. Sometimes things do, and in this case, they like lockstep together just right. I mean, it was just, you know, and even to the point where. You know, a couple other, you know, real potential spinoff projects that James and I are already talking about came out of it because it was very much this, like, here's this character and then here's this character and here's this character. And as I was putting the character together, it actually came up that one of the features the book includes, which is a relationship chart, was started with me saying, you know, I mentioned to James, I like these things. Do you like these things? He's like, I love those things. And so we talked about that. And then, you know, I kind of drew up a really simple one. And then, of course, they made it pretty.
actually, no, it wasn't they. It was Ruben. Ruben Bird. Ruben. Yeah, I give him all credit. I made some suggestions. He turned over to me the original chart that he turned over to me. It's pretty much what you see in the end. It's just that, you know, we had to keep updating the images as I finished the art.
Right.
But the one thing that I did ask him to do, kind of a little late in the game, but he, you know, he did it and it looks great, was to color code the arrows and the character frames, the frames around the images.
Because everybody listening should go out and buy the October Man. Let me tell you, when you look at it and you open up your copy, the relationship chart is just, it's better than I could have hoped for it to look. It was, I had sort of a vague idea of it sort of having a, you know, a little bit in there. And I was kind of thinking back to the old, like, vampire, you know, style ones. And it looks just really nice. I mean, it's really nice and it's very cool. And we've got a really neat feel. And also for those of you, you know, it's also followed up with actual sort of paragraph descriptions of the relationships of the characters that expound on a little bit. So you've got your quick and dirty sort of very, I think, very usable and very simple and very evocative relationship chart that tells how these characters interrelate to each other, because they don't really relate to each other in, you know, necessarily completely cooperative ways.
Certainly not a healthy family. No,
I think I said what the watchwords were: dysfunctional but effective, and I think that's exactly right. You know, they're scary, not nice, mystical mercenaries that you do not want to mess with, but they are not people that get along all the time, which means that you know, there is potential for the play for the GMs to sort of throw those little conflicts in as part of their games as a plot point. There's also potential for a savvy player to exploit that. I mean, definitely, there's one or two characters flat out that could be very easily, you know, maybe not easily, but could be turned on the rest of the group. Easily, probably not, but definitely could. It could happen. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, James. What do you want to talk about the characters a little bit? Just sort of
we can do that. I did want to mention for people who have asked. I am currently looking very carefully at doing an icons version of the Octobermen. We don't currently have plans to do that, but one of the things that we looked at when we were designing the characters is I really said, you know, I told Jack, look, just focus on Mutants and Masterminds, focus on, take advantage of the rules.
I may have taken that a bit too far.
Well, no, actually, I mean
that jokingly, because yeah. I think it's actually a real strength of the project. But yeah. I think you've got, there is stuff in this in this write-up that is really hard to do in other Supers games. Some fine Supers games out there. But there are certain characters that just won't work right in, say, icons. And so if Octoberman icons is done, James and I are probably going to have to sit down and say, you know, come up with some equally cool but more tailored towards icons bad guys to fill out a couple of the characters, but also find people that fit that niche.
Right.
Because there's definitely – the characters do fit together not only as a team power-wise, but they also fit together as a team personality-wise.
Right.
Or actually don't fit together as a character. But that's part of the charm. So yes. Having See. Sort of a come up with that might be sort of fun.
But yeah, actually it was kind of funny because Gareth, Michael Skarka, the publisher and of Icons, basically jumped on it as soon as I posted the file and you know, let everybody know that it was out on my social link pages, so it was at Facebook and Google Plus, which if you haven't, you know, you can find me under my name, James Dawsey, and the last name is Dawsey. Feel free to circle me or friend me. And, you know, you can keep up to date with the Vigilance Press stuff on our Facebook group, Vigilance Press. But anyway, going back to that, Gareth basically jumped on it and said, I love horror theme stuff. And I was kind of surprised by that. And he's like, tell me you're doing this for Icons. And I'm like, wow, I thought that was, you know, I kind of look at most of the Icons stuff and I kind of get this kind of Brave and the Bold feel for most of it. And it just makes me forget sometimes that, you know, you can, you know, as a super system, you can take it in a whole bunch of different directions.
Yeah, I knew Gareth loved horror stuff, but it was always pleased, though, that whenever you do anything and there's some other game designer or company guy out there just wanting to go, please do this for us. It's always
so
nice.
We're actively looking forward to doing an Icons version, but it won't be released. I mean,
it'll take a while.
It'll take a little while.
Yeah.
We got some other projects lined up that need to take priority. Otherwise, definitely. You know, my other writers start picking up pitchforks and giving me the hairy eyeball.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm awesome, folks. But yeah, I've got there's some other awesome stuff coming from other folks, and we should also be.
Yeah, we have some really great writers.
Also, know, gives some... me time to write stuff too, because like it's not like I'm not going to be writing a ton of stuff for Marvel.
Yeah, and you take so long to turn stuff in.
Yeah, I know. Seriously, like this thing. I hope I did not give James the wrong impression that I can apparently go bippity boppity boo and just summon up in like a couple weeks. A supplement on notice after we have sort of a half committed for me conversation at Gen Con. But that was basically how this happened. It really was. I dove into this with both feet and I was like, and then when he said, and I think part of it was his wonderful idea of, I want this in time for Halloween. And I was like, well, then this has to happen. But we could actually talk about the characters a little bit before
let's wrap. Give everybody a roster.
Like a little brief preview of what's going on and maybe a little insight into the characters. Maybe
should we
folks
go
who are
order...
on the bubble about it maybe or thinking about picking it up should see what's out there.
Should we go in order of appearance in the book or
I think that works
twistedness?
I think that's why. Let's go into Porter Wood's Pure as the books, because I'm not sure. Well, I know what I'd start with for most twisted, but I'm not sure where we go from there.
So. Yeah, I would start from least, but I can't pick out a least twisted character.
Well, I think weirdly enough, if we start in order of the book, we're going to start with least twisted. So yeah, sure. Let me see. Because I think Bookbinder is the least twisted.
Yeah, I think they came out in alphabetical, but let me double check.
Pretty sure they did.
And again, for people who have been listening, we are working on a version 2 already of the Octoberman. It's mainly we took some of the feedback that y'all gave us, and we're going through and cleaning up some of the presentation on some of the stat blocks.
Yeah, a few things need to be cleaned up a little bit. I mean, it's all really nice looking and usable now, but there's, you know,
we took some advice on how the layouts on the characters looked and what would make them easier to read, and we found some errata after publication. So,
and of course, anybody who downloaded it already can just download the update.
Exactly. Yeah. There will be an email going out when the new project goes live. And I'll also be, you know, once that's done, then we'll be ready to do the print on demand version, which will be the first print on demand project from Vigilance, but it will not be the last. We're going to start aiming on anything where we have a significant page count.
Yep.
Will be functional as a print-on-demand project from now on. So,
all right. So let's preview the Octoberman a little bit.
We have Bookbinder, which was one of the hardest pictures to draw because it took me a while to really crack a look for her that I felt made both of us happy. But once I did, it was easy.
Yeah. But Bookbinder is basically she's got sort of a literary and story-based magic. She used to work for this organization that I created for the book called The Library, which will probably now be showing up in its own thing, hopefully at some point in the future. Basically, The Library is sort of like a mystical version of S.H.I.E.L.D. with regards to magic rituals and magic artifacts and such. They make sure not quite as involved as S.H.I.E.L.D., but they're a little more, you know, kind of like the Watchers Council and Buffy too. They protect it and they keep it because they're keeping it for, you know, some future calamity. And of course, they don't all agree what that future calamity is. And so there's some internal strife and such. And Bookbinder basically was like an up and coming star in their organization. And she got bored being behind the scenes. She got bored being a researcher. She started delving into the secret art of bookbinding, which is basically her ability to take someone and draw them into a story, like literally, like she could open up a book and say a copy of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and she does her magic, and the next thing you know, you're fighting the giant squid. You know, basically, you know, that's she can do that. That's designed in Meets Masterminds as a movement attack power. I basically decided that the literary realms, basically, for which I maybe is a slight nod to Sandman, I think it's fair to say, are basically a place where stories exist in reality. And when you get, you know, if you fail, that, you know, your character gets sucked into one of these, you're trapped in the story. There's a link to Nullify that nullifies all genre inappropriate powers and abilities. So, you know, you get sucked into a comic book, you're probably lucky. you get sucked into Sense and Sensibility, and you may have a problem. and the only way to get out otherwise, other than obviously, you know, if you have a dimensional travel, you can do it yourself, or someone can come get you if they know where to find you. But the way to get out otherwise is to sort of get through the story, to resolve the story in some way.
One of the things I love about that is that it really gives the game master. I mean, you can pick up any book, and it suddenly becomes an adventure idea. You know, it's
and if you want to do like you could trap the whole team in it if you know, and have fun with her one character. You know, there's a lot of fun that can be had with that one way or the other. She's also got the ability, sort of the quote, you know, non-forbidden story magic and stuff that she has, which includes the ability to summon up characters out of fiction by opening up a book. She can do post-cognition on books, which lets her sort of like look back in a book. Or she can do post-cognition on something if she has a book on the subject. So let's say she wanted to look back and find out somewhere some lost Templar treasure was hidden. If she had a book on the Templars that discussed, you know, the area or whatever where the Templars operated when they hid that treasure, she might be able to figure out where it is. It's all very book and written word based magic. She has sort of a reality edit. I can't talk today. Power, which is sort of which is luck control, basically being able to sort of literally like sort of scribble out a line and write in a new line, sort of on your destiny. In small ways. She's a very potent character. She has three real limitations. You know, in there, basically, she's not, you know, that's her power. She's not, like, got all sorts of other physical, other might. Her power is, you know, it takes time to do. You know, she needs to be protected by the rest of the group. It makes her a great team player, but it also makes her, you know, a target. And so the, you know, and that's addressed not only with the other characters, but also in the team tactics and everything. So there's a whole, you know, she's really a cornerstone of some of the team tactics, but she's also vulnerable. And, it's a fun character, and it really is a character that I think is hard to make in some other games. Not in no other games, but definitely in some other games. I really had fun making that character the way that it came out. And it was, you know, ultimately, you know, on some level, it's kind of like sexy librarian with magic powers. It's kind of like Noriko Reedman from Read or Die. And then once I had that idea, I said, okay, well, now I have to do something completely different than that. I don't want to just copy that. And so that was kind of, you know, the initial basis. I also wanted a character, and this is going to become a lot more obvious when we talk about the other characters. I wanted a character who wasn't so freaking scary. Because I had a lot of them that were, and it was kind of nice to have a character in there that was maybe disturbing, but at least not, you know, like, what is wrong with me? Because that was actually asked once for one of the characters that's coming up. So. And so let's move on.
Moving on. One of the things I like about the next character is the Floating Skull. One of the things I like about him, and I haven't had a chance to do art for this, but is that in one throwaway phrase, you mentioned that, you know, basically the Floating Skull had... You know, well, let me go ahead and let you describe the Floating Skull, and I'll tell you what it is.
Okay, the Floating Skull is basically he's a Victorian occultist. You know, back a lot of spiritualism and occultism was really big back in the Victorian age. People got into it, was very faddy. People joined societies like one of the big societies was the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which guys like Arthur Machen, Aleister Crowley, and stuff were all a member of. He was one of these guys. He was kind of into this whole thing. He got involved in dark rituals and everything, and then he ended up making a deal with the demon, and some of the things went wrong. And at the end of the day, he ended up with sort of that, like, you know, fairly classic, you know, eternal life, like, sideways screw, where he's, like, trapped in this, he's trapped in his own head, literally. You know, his consciousness is in his skull. He can, like, float around and move around, but he has no body. You know, he can't do any, you know, he can't, you know, he's got power. He's got knowledge because he was a very powerful, knowledgeable occultist, but he doesn't really have, like, he's still kind of stuck. I mean, he doesn't have his own body. He doesn't have his own anything. And the Floating Skull was interesting because he went through two iterations of design, and I think the first iteration I rightly threw out. When I first started making the guy, I just said, I want to do a floating head skull guy. That'd be kind of fun. And I started giving him things like move object so he could, like, move things around. And I started giving him things that basically let him sort of have a body, you know, mimic having a body without having a body. And I got about halfway through that build, and I said, this is not work. This isn't interesting. I mean, at least not to me. I mean, it's an interesting character, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. This guy's supposed to not like being stuck in a floating skull, and I basically was giving him the ability to do everything a person can do, except he's a floating head. So I said, well, how can I make a character who basically his physical abilities involve floating there and making smart, snarky comments, who is really dangerous? And I start, you know, and of course, you don't have a character with a lot of, you know, dexterity or agility or whatever when you're a floating head. So I started working on the idea of, you know, it's one of the times when, you know, a lot of people caution against use of variable power pools. And I think they're generally right too. But in this case, I was like, he's a master of curses. He's a master of curse magic. You know, 666 dreadful curses. And that came to the idea of, like, well, I don't want to stat up 666 dreadful curses. And I certainly want to give people a opportunity to create their own. So I came up with the variable power pool. I gave some example curses. With the quirk, no curse can be used on the same person twice. So on the off chance that you survive all 666 of them, you're safe. the other thing I liked about that was it's a character that is going to hit you with something, but it's not just going to spam the effective things over and over again.
Right.
You know, you're going to get hit by, you know, there's, and some of them are direct attacks. Like I have one that's called like the Curse of the Storm God. That's a perception based, lightning attack. Lightning comes down from the sky and smashes into you and hits you. You get struck by lightning, you know, cause you got cursed and that's what it does, but you don't get hit by lightning over and over and over again. If you survive that, he's got to do something else to you. Now he may do the curse of the fire god or whatever. I mean, he may come up with something else similar, thematically similar, but you can't just keep hitting the same things over and over again.
Right.
So I think it's kind of fun. It also leads to some really fun curses that I think sometimes people don't always think of. that can be tailored to a particular thing. Like one of the ones, actually, my favorite curse that I came up with was the Curse of Icarus, which nullifies flight. And, you know, that's an inconvenience for any flying character. That's a big problem for flying characters who aren't super durable. And I kind of like, you know, ability to have a character like that. But also, I kind of want to design a character that I really wanted the PCs to just hate. Like, he's not a nice guy. He's smarmy. He's sarcastic. He's full of all sorts of forbidden occult knowledge that will cause no end of trouble. And he has an ability to sort of, like, curse you and mess with you. I didn't want to make a character that, like, was going to seem unfair because he's got a lot of vulnerabilities that you can use to exploit. I mean, he is a floating head, and he doesn't have a lot of other abilities. But I really wanted the character, like, you know, that, you know, when you pull yourself out of the rubble because he, you know, hit you with the Curse of Icarus and you crashed into a building, and then he, you know, hit you with, like, you know, some sort of curse that caused the building to collapse on you or whatever. I really want when the hero pulls himself out of the rubble to go, I am just going to beat that guy's skull in, literally. I just really wanted a character that would do that without seeming sort of unfair, and I think he's kind of got that going on, so...
Yeah, I think one of the few occasions where I've seen a variable power used in a way that makes me happy. And yeah. Going back to what I was saying visually as an artist, when I sat down to draw him, I'm like, oh, he's a floating skull. And I was looking through it, I'm like, oh, but he was, you mentioned, what was the line? Bonded to his decapitated head and later his fleshless skull. So I'm like, wow, if we went back and did like, a Victorian period version of the Octoberman, I would really, you know, love to draw the kind of floating zombie head version.
Yeah, I mean,
of Teasbury.
Also, the name Professor Teasbury. I was saying he was called the floating skull because he's a floating skull, and I had a brief moment of thinking I should come up with something better than that, and I don't know. I can't later decided that floating skull was perfect because it was exactly right. And I was talking to my friend Jason, who Englert, who's a guy I've known for years, a fellow game designer, kind of out of the industry now, but he used to do some stuff. And I was sitting there going, you know, well, I don't know what else to call him. And he's like, well, you know, floating skull's perfect. Why are you coming up with some new thing? Stop trying to reinvent the wheel. That's perfect. And I said, I smile, what's his normal name? And he just looks at me with this look of just like, I pulled something out of ether and goes, Professor Teasberry. Just like throw it, like almost dismissively. And I look at him and go, perfect. So that was, you know, and that's
yeah, and I have to say that if you know, for you Buffy fans out here, the actor that immediately jumped to mind when he started describing this character to me, and the name is so appropriate, but the actor as well, his name is Anthony Head, and if you've seen if you've seen the Buffy the Vampire Slayer TV show, he's her watcher, right? He's the guy who hangs out in the library and coaches Buffy and her friends. Yeah. So just that's the actor that I always picture in my head when I'm running a floating skull. I would love for him to be able to do the voice.
Yeah. All right, so we've got the floating skull, we've got Bookbinder. Are we on to Hexenwolf?
Oh, and just to give you guys an idea, the floating skull is power level 12, and Bookbinder is power level 11. So just to kind of give you guys an idea, the power level range in this book is between about 9 and 12.
And the 9 character has an a power level 8 sidekick.
Right, yeah. So
so around, you know, I would say probably around 11-ish, but, you know, a good solid team of 10, power level 10 guys probably have a decent shot as long as they...
You know, depending on how you want to use them, if you want to use them as like a you know, kind of a primary focus villain, they're a great villain team for a power level 10 game.
Yeah, it's not how dirty they fight, really.
Yeah, and again, but if they're there as kind of a support mechanism for another campaign, they could easily give some power level 10 or 11 or 12 heroes a good run for their money.
Hexenwolf. Hexenwolf is basically, I wanted to do a werewolf, and I know James had done a lot of, like, wolfmen werewolves, and I wanted to do a guy who wasn't. I wanted a guy who turned into a giant wolf, and I also wanted to do a version of a werewolf that is, you know, not seen nearly so much in fiction and such, is the takes the enchanted wolf skin and wraps around himself and turns into the creature. And so I sort of threw all these ideas together to come up with this Sort of ex-big game hunter guy who learns this ritual and becomes this ultimate predator. And he's very not a nice man. He is very much a, sociopathic sort of Kraven the Hunter-ish, but instead of, having Kraven's physical abilities, he actually has a limp because he was mangled badly by a beast on one of his hunts. And so now his way of being a hunter is to put on this skin and be a hunter. And, since he's hunted everything else, hunting mages and people for whoever that the Octomermen are hired to deal with and hired to eliminate or whatever, he's this weird mix of sort of assassin and frontline fighter and tracker, because he's very powerful but he's also very combat focused, but he's also stealthy and he's dangerous. I mean, he's the idea to be a guy who's a big, scary, dangerous, like werewolf character, but maybe a little bit different than the standard sort of wolfman. And which I know gave Jameson fits when drawing him initially, but I think the end result was really cool. So,
but it's like I kept wanting to like skew more towards the crazy monster thing. He's like, no, just make him a wolf. Make him a wolf.
I'm like, make him a big wolf. I mean, a giant wolf. A scary wolf, but just a wolf. And I think the end result was good. I think it's definitely different, and I think it's very sort of predatory and scary. I actually really like wolves as animals, and so I always feel a little bit bad whenever I make sort of an evil wolf dude, which was the other reason why I kind of liked this guy, because he is almost weirdly he almost follows that theme of mine, because it's like, well, he basically is perverting this creature, and he's taking it and he's using it for his own sort of very human, very selfish, very nasty desires to be sort of the top dog and mm-hmm. show that he's in charge. He's also probably a good source of internal tension for the group, because he's very predatory, and his line, he's
very ambitious.
He's very ambitious. He's used to being in charge. He's rich. He's wealthy. He's used to being in charge, and now he's like a soldier guy, and he'll be a good little soldier until things go wrong. And that's actually sort of talked about a little bit in the book. So, but no, he's a big scary werewolf guy. He's got a few little neat tricks. He's very resistant to magic, which is nice. If you're using this character in a magical themed game, they're gonna really not like Hexenwolf, because they're gonna be firing off stuff at him, and he's not immune to magic. I did something that I like to do with resistant characters. He's got an immunity of half effect, but it's still enough with his other abilities that it's gonna be one of those things where your resident Doctor Strange guy is probably going to have some choice curse words for Hexenwolf, especially since he's very good at hunting down people and taking them out. So it's especially if he's got a good setup or a good way to hit from ambush, which I think, unless I'm wrong, leads us into our next character.
Yeah, you have a couple of characters here who are designed at sneaking up on people. Yeah. And just for people's edification, I had nothing to do with the idea that follows here. This was all Jack. And this is the moment where I realized this is not Four Color Comics. This is a lot more Vertigo than I usually go. But, when you ask somebody for a Halloween team, you really can't put the brakes on him.
Yeah.
And
this is the character that when I asked my friend Jason, who I mentioned earlier, who gave me the Professor Teasberry name, also turned around and said, I shot this concept at him when we were talking about it, and he looked at me and goes, what precisely is wrong with you? So L'Enfant Terrible, which is probably a fairly terrible mangled French pronunciation, but it's French for the terrible child. And I kind of wanted to do a Damien character. I wanted to do the evil kid. It's a classic staple of scary movies. But I didn't want to do the Antichrist. I already had a demon guy, which we'll get to in a bit, who I really liked. And I didn't want to do – and so I said, well, what if the kid's not even really that supernatural? What if he's just evil? And we're not going in on that sort of classical fear, I think, we have of something wrong with your children, something wrong with the child. Something is wrong with the child, and there's just wrong. It's not nature. It's not nurture. You can't fix it. No amount of love, no amount of compassion is ever going to fix this. This kid is just dark. Well, that's L'Enfant. That's what he is. That is exactly what he is. He was born that way. He is basically this sucking hole of evil and blackness, and he will never be any better. All he will ever do is get older and wiser and more dangerous if he is allowed to continue, which I think also creates a really interesting dilemma for characters, because what do you do for a villain like that? He's not that dangerous right now on his own right now. He's a power level 9 character without any real superpowers that are externally focused. But what happens if he is allowed to continue? And his sidekick is actually a weird little lens into that, because Mr. Bear is his sidekick, who's basically his uncle in a bear suit. But he has basically broken the guy's sanity and turned him into this sort of animalistic sort of, you know, pet. And he basically uses him to, you know, follow him around and treats him like an imaginary friend and pet. But he's not imaginary, and he's a messed up, like, you know, dude in a teddy bear costume with knives for hands. So it's
one of the things that that struck me was when I first started promoting the Octoberman and showing people the artwork as it was finished. I posted a L'Enfant by himself, and everyone was like, "Oh, hey, nice drawing." And then I posted a 2-shot of him with Mr. Bear, and people instantly looked at it, and went, "That's creepy."
Yeah,
the existence of the man in the bear costume. I purposely went out of my way to make him kind of raggedy.
Yeah. His explanation of how it all happened too is not. I don't go into super like graphic detail. I'm not trying to like gross anybody out, but you know, basically, this kid's terrible. I mean, he's just a terrible, terrible person. Except he happens to be young and innocent looking, and his powers actually even are based around the two ideas that he is young and innocent looking, and even on some level undetectable. His evil is so much a part of himself. You can't really just like cast detect evil or whatever and find him. But also, you know, there's this darkness inside of him that makes him very deceptive and very. He's got very high social skills, and he's got the various, and he's got a lot of the various social advantages like fascinate, daze, etc., setup, redirect, teamwork. He's a great team player if you accept that the team he plays for is terrible, and he is real. And I think he potentially hits your potential hero PCs where sometimes they are easier to hurt, which is the social skills and such, where they may not always be quite so bumped up on that. And it means you have a power. I think you have a power level 9 character who's actually really scary, maybe not on his own, but like what he can set up and what he can make happen. The other thing there is the fact that it also let me have a lot of fun with the character. Like, he's got favored foes, people who like children. I mean, or people who think children are harmless or something to that effect. I don't remember the exact wording. So he's really dangerous in his own little twisted little rugrat with a power tools way and a murderous teddy bear. Yeah, and James is completely not responsible for that. I don't even know where that came from. That was just me. But that's the character. He's sort of the weird weird combination of a little brother and like assassin for the group. He's like this terrible combination of like hitman, chief interrogator, inquisitor, torturer, and like sidekick. And it's, which I figured was appropriate for a group like this. So, and again, this is probably where you start ratcheting up the appropriate age level a little bit.
Right. Yeah, that is one thing we did. I did try to make clear in the descriptions for the sales. For anyone who's listening, I really recommend this product for older teens.
I will also say for folks, you know, if you're worried about like lots of like sex and bloody gore stuff, that when we're talking about it being more mature, we're really talking about concepts here. We're not talking about like, you know, it's not like terribly disgusting art or really stuff like that.
There's no imagery that keys into this stuff. It's all purely implied.
It is purely conceptual and sort of the natural concepts that would come out if you use these guys in a game as they're written. I mean, they could certainly be dialed down. They could be made a little more traditional comic book horror. One of these days, maybe closer to Halloween, I'm on more of a schedule than I'd like. I'd love to talk about horror comics and horror in Marvel and DC and stuff, and maybe even sort of revisit some of the concepts from the Octoberman a little bit more from that lens. But yeah, we're talking like that kind of stuff, not like Saw or whatever. So don't worry about it in that regard. It is something. Yeah, you know, a little mature. So we're moving on to, that's L'Enfant. I don't want to spoil any more of his weirdness, but he's got a lot of it. But he's fun. I think he also has a lot of fun powers and stuff. I had a lot of fun with naming his powers and stuff in that regard, because I just thought they were fun.
I think the next character is one of those characters that I instantly fell in love with. This is actually the one we were talking about where you originally conceived of her as a vampire.
Well, the idea of basically someone who was a nun who turned into a vampire and sort of lost her way by being turned into something that was unholy. And that was a good basic idea. James wanted something not so vampiric, and by sort of challenging me to do that, I think we came up with a much stronger character, which was ultimately a character who was given a choice to, was possessed / tormented by otherworldly creatures, in this case, the sort of unseelie fae, and was given a choice saying, we can make it stop if you will if you will just surrender to us, you'll become ours. And it is kind of a classic devil's bargain. It is sort of a classic demon possession, but like I said, I already had a demon, so I wanted to do something else. And, you know, it's a really tragic character because she was maybe, maybe she was a little pompous because she was devoutly religious and very, and some of the hints, without being too preachy, I kind of imply that, you know, she had her flaws. She had her hubris in there, in her character, but at the same time, she was also, you know, this young nun who worked with worked with charities and went and, you know, worked with underprivileged people and was, you know, tried to help people and whatever. And then she, you know, this happened to her and she became this completely different character. And, you know, she really became this sort of, and the power worked with, and the powers all revolve around blood. And, you know, she has the ability to, you know, make people bleed and make things out of blood and make, one of her big things is she can actually form blood into objects and she can make weapons and such out of blood. You know, she's in the illustration, she's featured with like her claws. You can see it on the cover too. But you know, it's not the only thing she can do. She's got some other neat little tricks with it. And, you know, there's something that I kind of like to do with characters like that, would have like a little arsenal or whatever. There are actually reasons for using every single one of her little weapons. They're not major, but they're not just pure flavor either. You know, you might want to use the claws on a particular foe, and then you might want to use the blades on another foe, and et cetera, et cetera.
What I liked about her was, you know, you usually think of somebody like this as kind of as someone who hangs back, but she's really a melee artist.
I kind of wanted to make a character sort of who was like fell into that weird sort of 90s bad girl ninja girl thing, but not have the origin and everything that those characters usually have, and have somebody, quite frankly, with a lot more depth than some of those characters had, and a lot more, you know, reason behind it and a lot more personality. And then that was really my focus there, was, you know, to have somebody who is, you know, at a heart, it's like, well, you know, she's kind of a sexy nun, and then like turn this into a character that when you read about it, you're like, wow, that's actually kind of sad. You know, that's actually like legitimately sad. It's not just, you know, not to mock the characters who had, like, you know, their families killed and whatever and wanted revenge, but that's been that well's been dipped to so many times for sort of the close up fighter, nasty, I'm a little crazy and I'm dangerous characters, that coming up with somebody more who's sort of this like weird, you know, tied to the fae and, you know, very, you know, we used to be very religious and has sort of transferred that religious devotion to a new sort of otherworldly power and that actually does feature into even why she's with the group. That's actually in her backstory that even the reason why she's with them. It's not just because, you know, oh, they picked her up somewhere, you know, ripping the spine out of some dude, you know, they actually, which is, you know, probably also the character. If anybody was looking for role-playing notes with this character, I really see her a little bit she has a little few shades of Drusilla from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. She is insane. And it seems all fun and kind of cute until you realize she's profoundly murderously insane. And then you're like, and then it becomes even more disturbing because you're like, wow, well, she's cute and she's funny. I mean, but she wants, you know, like her and L'Enfant get along very well. And she's sort of a big sister to him, or sort of a mother figure. And, you know, they like to play together. Well, think about those characters playing together. It's terrible. You know, so it's that kind of thing. So, honestly, the other thing I kind of like the idea is that as terrible as the goals of the main leader of the group is, which I think we're leading up to, he's not necessarily the most evil character on the team.
Yeah, he's certainly not the creepiest.
No, he's not the creepiest. He's at least, and so let's talk about him now.
Spring-heeled Jack. Now, for you know, my first readings on Spring-heeled Jack always kind of gave me an idea of somebody who's like the idea of a space invader before the idea of outer space really was solidified in people's minds. Yeah. But he had like a silver helmet and blue fire, blah blah blah. But what Jack's come up with here is, I started sketching and drawing, I just started going, he's like, I kind of originally started with like a more prissy kind of Victorian attitude with just like a leather fetish thrown on top of it.
Yeah.
But, what I finally realized was I wanted somebody who was a more dynamic right. image, and so I kind of went with a more modern look for his outfit. Yeah, but
and we also may note, you know, people will note, and I think this is actually, we don't ever say this in the text because of the artwork, but you know, he's got a slightly different coat on the cover than he does inside. I think it's fair to say that since his clothing is sort of clothing for those folks who pick up the October and want to use it, hey, guy probably wears whatever sort of dynamic fashion you think is appropriate. I mean,
exactly.
It's not just a you can't draw a character in 17 different outfits if he wears different clothes. So it's kind of, you know, I mean, like there's a picture of Hexenwolf in his norm, in his human guise in the book as well. And, you know, clearly it just gives you an idea that the guy tends to wear sort of high end business attire. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's all he ever wears is that one particular suit. I mean, definitely, you know, have fun with that with characters. Yeah, Springhill Jack was like, I kind of lost the silver helmet, but I kept the blue flame. He's, you know, he is, though, in a lot of ways, he's a half demon. That ties completely into not only his origin, but the whole origin of the and focus behind the Octobermen. That basically the entire reason they were gathered together by him is due to his goal as he's a half demon, and that is not good enough for him. He wants to take over, and he wants to be a full demon. He wants to sort of, you know, become a prince of hell. His father was, you know, a very, very powerful lord in hell. A demon lord in hell, and he wants to take over. He wants to get that power, and we don't go super into it, but we kind of talk about how in this particular version of the Inferno, which I think is fair, you know, there's strict inheritance laws. You know, humans can't inherit. You know, you can't be weak. So you can't have human weakness or whatever. So if he wants to become a human, he has to sort of pay the toll and transform completely, and that's his goal, which not only leads to using the character at all, but also leads to how much you want to use the character. If somebody really wants to use the Octobermen in a continuing story, there is definitely a campaign potential for, you know, this is a story of how Springhill Jack tries to gather the 13 souls he needs to become a true demon. And if he does, oh boy, you know, I mean, he's already a power level 12, pretty potent character.
Right.
And that's his half power. And that was kind of the intention of the guy, was like, this is him at, you know, obviously, I don't want to probably hit power level 24, but we're certainly talking about a significant increase. Those folks who picked up the GM's guide and looked at the Elder Evil, we'd be trending in that direction more for a character like that. And that's like a power level 15, 16 guy. So we're definitely looking at a major increase.
Think graduating from what he is now to something a little more like Trigun.
Yeah, more like Trigun, you know, or Asmodeus, or all the various devil stand-ins in DC and Marvel. That would be really what he would be doing. Right now he's like a little bit below. He's shy of Etrigan the Demon, but not by a ton. And he would be bumping up to more along, like you said, Trigun. So you're talking about a significant increase. You know, he's got the blue fire thing that he has in Legend. He's got the Springhill thing. He's very athletic and can jump around and whatever. It's kind of fun to make a demon supernatural guy who doesn't fly. That's not his main mode of conveyance. You know, he's got some nifty powers. He's got the other sort of wacky movement based power in the game, which he can literally send someone to hell. There are reasons why he doesn't always use that power tactically. And those are also explained in the book. So, you know,
one of the things I liked, and I think somebody commented on this in a review, was that the two movement attack powers that you've listed here both have very different almost mechanics behind them,
yes.
but flavors as well. So that was one of the things I really like about your writing is that tie in, you know, the actual rules of the game into the flavor of the character.
Well, you know, and that was one of the things I wanted to do, particularly with stuff like that. And the other thing I wanted to do was having fun with some of these extras and flaws that don't get used nearly so often as much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was never shoehorning it in, but I was always finding myself going, like, for example, I believe both of, and I'm, but I know at least one of the movement powers are reversible. And, you know, that sounds like, oh, well, so what? You can reverse it and turn it off. When you start kind of thinking about a villain and you have the guy who can do something and then snap his fingers and reverse it, it gives you infinite hostage situations. It gives you infinite bartering capacity. It gives you fun role-playing potentials. I mean, it's kind of the idea of, you know, I mean, it's a movement power. It's not like a disintegrate or something. But, you know, let's say you had a disintegrate power and the guy, you know, disintegrates – you don't even have to be a person. He disintegrates like the, you know, the cure for this disease or whatever that, you know, the guy's going after, and he disintegrates it and he's got reversible. And he says, well, if I snap my fingers, I can bring it back. But if you don't, do what I say, then it's gone forever. And, you know, the kind of idea of, like, you know, being able to do this with characters, trapping them somewhere or pushing them somewhere or moving them around somewhere and being able to sort of barter for that. I mean, it's a fun thing. It's a great role-playing thing. And there's also a very simple and, quite frankly, fairly affordable, like it's one point, you know, extra there to do that with. And kind of having fun with that. And I mean, there's other bits in for the other characters like that. But having fun with things like, you know, innate and resistible. I mean, I know, you know, I actually think some of my uses of innate were for L'Enfant were good. Not so much because they were super important, but it just kind of was that punctuation point on all these abilities. Like, he's just like this. You know? Not, you know, he... like, evil little kid, maybe we can, he's just like this. You know, that was the sort of using, I mean, in a lot of ways, innate was like my dire punctuation point on certain abilities for characters. It was like, you know, he's just like, this guy's a demon, maybe we can, he's just like this. You know, have that sort of thing there to kind of poke people with a bit. But no, Three-Hole Jack was fun. He also, you know, he is the motivating factor. There's a lot of talk in the relationship section about how he plays everybody off against each other. He is very smart. He is hundreds of years old, or he's a couple hundred years old. He's born in the 19th century, and he is smart. He is, you know, it's hinted at this is not the only version of the Octoberman he has ever put together. That some of the characters may still be around, some of them may not be. I mean, some of the characters are listed as how long they've been with the group. Obviously, for example, L'Enfant Terrible, being a child, has not been around since the 1800s. But there are some of the other characters, it's a little more vague on how long they've been with the group for anybody running a more historical game. Though, of course, you could also just, you know, there's no harm in using these guys exactly when they show up, too. You know, I mean, there's really nothing in these characters, and James might feel differently, but I certainly don't, except maybe, you know, Bookbinder's use of a Kindle. to say,
yeah, that's something you could easily swap that out for a bag of books, which was actually the original concept we had, or the bag of books. But I just kept drawing it. I'm like, man, a big old bag of books is just not sexy, and it's not very modern. And she just felt like a more modern character than the rest of them.
You could totally have them in the 1940s, 1950s, 60s. I mean, you could be running, like, you know, you could have these guys show up in a Victorian super game you're running. I mean, they really are. There's really not much. I mean, that was also my other thing with making a mystical team. I didn't want to tie them to the modern day because mystical teams usually aren't.
Right.
So, but no, so that's the Octoberman in a nutshell. Like I said, there's some adventures in the back, too. I'm going to talk with, introduce a couple other minor characters.
Venture Seeds. We've got two NPCs that are both magic users.
Which I would sort of describe as a bargain basement Felix Faust and a much less, and a Suicide Girl version of Zatanna. So to entice people if they want, those are the character sort of ideas there a little bit. And also not nearly as powerful as Zatanna because they're NPCs for a story, but they're NPCs for a session, but they are there. They're definitely fun and kind of showcase the rest of the sort of setting. Yeah. I think in a lot of ways, the Octoberman also sort of almost around the edges are almost, they're not really a setting in and of themselves, but they could be a campaign in and of themselves. If somebody right. wants to. I mean, these guys are, I think, groups are going to want to stop these guys. You know, that's one thing I think that sometimes gets lost occasionally on villains is, you know, I stop them because that's what I do. You're going to want to stop these guys. They're terrible. I mean, even if they've got, like, you know, Spring-Heeled Jack has a sense of honor and Bookbinder's not as evil as the rest of them, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I can sing their virtues such as they are. You know, the kid doesn't have reached his full adult strength yet. I think that's honestly the best thing I can say about him. Seriously, I mean, really, wow.
So it's like, I think the best thing I can say about him is that he's not as bad as he could get.
Yeah, exactly. Which is a whole other plot line. I mean, you know, if at some point you want to run a story, you know, you could use this, you could start from the innards of the group, you bleed him around a little bit, probably a poor choice of words, and then you get to the end of an arc, and, you know, there's a big push, and, you know, Jack makes his final push to become a demon lord, and if he wins, then you've got an entirely amped up, like, terribly crazy group to deal with, or, you know, or alternatively you stop him, you know, and but he's not going to give up, you know. So I think there's a lot of fun with this group. I think it's great for Halloween themed stuff too. Anybody who's thinking about running a spooky Halloween supers game, that's definitely going to be spooky. And there's, you know, there's adventure sheet ideas and everything in there. I think there's a lot of fun. I guess the reviews have said, and I'm glad they do, because I was certainly trying to come up with some alternate power builds and some stuff without doing weird for the sake of weird. Like, that was my one sort of challenge to myself, was do something kind of weird and creepy and supernatural without being weird for the sake of weird. And I like to think that that was sort of the meat. I think it worked. I mean, it seems to me it did. And I certainly hope people will pick it up and explore that and have fun with that and give James a bunch of money, because he certainly deserves it. So. But yeah. I think that's the Octoberman in a nutshell. Like I said, we got the My Threat Report coming earlier, and then the adventure. So you will be sick of my writing soon. But if you're not sick of my writing soon, I also did some work on the Emerald City book. Not a lot, but a little bit. I did some work for the DC Universe book. Ditto. And I'm also currently one of the writers for the Marvel RPG that's coming out from Margot Weiss Productions.
Yeah, Marvel Heroes, I believe, right?
Marvel Heroes, yes. Yep. I'll be working on that, and I'll be working on that quite a bit. So I can't say much more about it because of non-disclosure agreements and all, but I will be a pretty – looks like a pretty hefty contributor to that.
Yeah, so. I really like what Cam had to say when he was on the show and talking to him. I got a real sense of the potential for the game.
It's fun, and it's nice to see something out there that's well done. Got a good team, a good guy in charge of it, because Cam's great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, putting together a really good team. You know, I mean, excluding myself, of course. I just lucked into it. I had to blackmail somebody. You know, and having a game that is going to be really fun and really great and distinctly different than Smash Mind, which is also really fun and really great.
Yeah.
And so. I think that that's... I really like that. I like that there are multiple games out there in a genre like superheroes, and not only like for different players, but even for the same players in a different mood. Because I like Smallville. I like what I've seen in Marvel Heroes a lot. I love Meet Some Masterminds. I like Icons. It just depends on what mood I'm in or what I want to do exactly. And it's kind of like what James said about, you know, the Octoberman fits a mood and a style and a design that won't work for Icons exactly as we wrote it. But, you know, that doesn't mean that there's not appropriate stuff for Icons and that there isn't a place. I mean, I could probably do the reverse and write stuff for Icons that, you know, would be means Masterminds wouldn't quite work for. So,
right. And I think that actually shows the strengths of each system is that they are tailor-made for certain kinds of role play. And that's basically... You know, it's something that I've been trying to keep in mind going forward is that we want to have, and we do have plans for several products that will be released in both Mutants and Masterminds and Icons,
some of them won't quite work for that.
Right. Some of them will. I'm going to try and hone the differences between the two releases to take advantage of each system.
Right.
Really is the goal and not leave.
And I think players
feeling cheated in any way.
And for anybody listening and sort of wanting some insight into the game design of gaming industry, I'm going to say as a designer who's worked for a lot of companies myself, it's really great to hear James say something like that, because you know there are a lot of companies out there that have that mindset. I think Masterminds has that mindset. You know, a lot of times, you know, I would hear John or Steve say, you know, does this add to what we're looking at, what we want to do, how we're viewing things. I feel that that's definitely the case with Margot Weiss Productions. I've been working with them. I can name some other companies overhaul. I'm just going to pimp the ones that I've currently been working with. but at the same time, there are a lot of companies out there that don't. There are a lot of creators that don't. And, you know, that's not and that's fine. But I personally really like the idea that somebody looks at what they've got and says, you know, this works for this and it works for this because of the strengths of this. You know, not because we just are going to plug it into every single place we can plug it into. And, you know, but it's also nice to hear him say something like, you know, well, you know, maybe we'll do an Icons version of the Octoberman and we'll change some stuff up a little bit to make it a little more fun for that particular group, you know, because it's a good idea and there's a lot of stuff. There is a lot of stuff that can be used, but some of it doesn't quite work. So, you know, that's also a good thing to do. So, you know, basically, folks, support people like that, because we don't have enough of them and we need more. And you know, buy my work, because I want people to buy my work. So I think that pretty much sums up my views on everything now.
Once again, I wanted to thank John Lighthouser for coming on the other day and talking about the Game Master's Guide. That's new for Mutants and Masterminds, if anybody hasn't picked it up yet.
Like, after you run out and pick up the Octoberman, you should totally pick that up too.
Yeah. definitely they both there's a lot of stuff in there on running villains, yeah. And
awesome, nice stuff, nice, yeah. really nice product.
So a lot of good stuff this Halloween. Really excited about all the stuff coming out, especially coming out from us, but you know, other stuff as well.
Yeah, some really fantastic
there's
stuff.
There's this other company out there called Green Ronin that does a couple of
you
nice things.
You may have heard of them. I did a little. Well, anyway,
I think we covered all the bases. Yep. So if anybody has any questions or comments, I invite you guys to comment on the podcast. You can find us at vigilancepress.com. You can also find me haunting the forums at the Atomic Think Tank, and message me there. Or you can email me directly, james@jamesdossie.com. Just put letter to the editor in the subject line, and I'll actually collect those, and the ones that I think deserve like a public answer. I'll try to answer each email, but I may publish them in an upcoming supplement. You know, I'm going to try and do some letters.
Rock the old comic book stuff. So that's cool.
Yeah. So you may get your stuff answered in one of our supplements coming up. So
cool.
Hopefully everybody will give us some good strong feedback and help us make better stuff going forward. But everybody look forward to the version 2 of Octoberman should go live by this weekend. You don't have to wait. It's available for sale right now, and you'll automatically get updated.
For God's sakes, don't wait. Go get it right now. What are you waiting for? You should be buying it right now.
And we'll be going to print on demand hopefully by next week.
All right, cool.
So thanks again for stopping by.
No problem. My pleasure.
And for everyone else listening, stay vigilant.
Stay vigilant.